This webcast was brought to you by the Library Science Program at the University of Missouri.
Jack silently thanked the Parodendron who had saved them from the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Thank him.
That's right. Annie put the dinosaur back with the other books. Then she gasped. Wow, she whispered, look at this.
Dreams, books, are each a world, and books, we know, are a substantial world, both pure and good. That according to William Wordsworth. Logan Pearsall Smith had this to say on the topic. People say that life is the thing, but I prefer reading. I can agree with that. The Tiger Eye Reading Room is a dedicated space on the ground floor of Townsend Hall on the University of Missouri campus. In the reading room, youth services librarians in training and early childhood educators create story times for preschoolers enrolled in the Child Development Lab program. It's a magical experience that does not translate into statistics or outcome measures or any other quantifiable evaluation system, but it is a microcosm of and almost complete justification for the entire cycle of authorship, publishing, reading, and librarianship. The Tiger Eye Reading Room series of interviews and discussions brings together all aspects of this cycle. We will be talking to authors, readers, booksellers, children, reading adults, and the occasional librarian or two. We'll try and look at all aspects of the world of books and see what connections can be made or different viewpoints expressed. And it's another Tiger Eye Reading Room. We're here in our continuing series about reading and books and authors and publishing and all that sort of thing. And we're talking with young Tim Lacey, who is a scholar, as it happens, of a certain kind of reading and certain types of books. It also turns out that Tim is an MU undergrad with a degree in chemistry, as I recall it. And I'm going to start off by asking Tim how he wound up, moved from chemistry to Mortimer Adler and the great books.
Thanks for asking. That is, it's great that as an intro, because of the fact that I grew up with the attitude that the sciences were a kind of, well, were the professional endeavor that one went to college to learn, right? Sort of the sciences and engineering. Being from rural western Missouri, there were basically three or four reasons why people would go to college, and it's law, medicine, and engineering. So I came in with a sort of narrow view of what my undergraduate experience could be like. So anyway, I started in engineering and spent a lot of time there, not far from the School of Education there on the west side of campus, and eventually sort of kept tweaking and failing at certain parts of my in my classes, and moved my way over to chemistry and settled on that for the last two or three years I was at Missouri. But that chemistry degree enabled me to get a job with the Department of Natural Resources in Jefferson City. And what I was doing there was exploring hazardous waste sites, their history, what made them polluted. And in the course of researching those sites, I became interested in the field of history. And at the same time, after I'd graduated from Missouri, a friend of mine had introduced me to the great books, and I took to this as a way to sort of make up for deficiencies, or what I felt were deficiencies in my experience at Missouri. And so these things came together when I left Missouri in 1997 and moved to Chicago and enrolled in graduate program in history at Loyola University of Chicago. Now, it took a few years there floundering around before I stumbled back on the topic of the great books themselves, and discovered that relatively few people had explored either the history of the great books or Mortimer Adler's life.
Which is interesting, considering the guy's stature in in education, that connection with the University of Chicago and all that. I mean, I would have thought everybody would have studied that to a pin drop.
Yeah, I'm Adler is a controversial figure, mostly of his own making. he vacillated a bit on his views of the great books early on. He was fairly dogmatic, and then in the 1980s, he became a bit more liberal in terms of what he saw as inclusive of the great books idea. But then there in 1990, when they released the second edition of the great books, he became very dogmatic again about the criteria of inclusion. And it's the episodes in the press around the 1990 re-release of the great books that have caused this lack of sympathy for Adler's place in the history of education and philosophy.
Well, maybe it was his timing, in a sense, in that it seems to me Harold Bloom was on a rampage around that same time frame, and I think it's very easy to lump those two together. We kind of had this conversation at the conference that you and I both attended in Wisconsin a couple of weeks ago, which is one of the reasons I wanted to follow up with you.
Right. Yeah, Alan Bloom was certainly the promoter of the classics extraordinaire there from maybe 87 to 89. He was a polarizing figure, and people tended to lump Adler in with Alan Bloom as sort of the conservative advocates of studying only the ancient classics.
Dead white guys.
Yeah, yeah, whereas the great books themselves, it was a more inclusive term, where ancient classics were underneath of that idea, but great books included works from the modern period and Europe and even in 20th century America. So now, of course, there are problems with that, right? There was a comparative lack of women and people of color in terms of the authors, but still the great books idea itself was more liberal than the conservative classics that were advocated by Alan Bloom.
Mm-hmm. Just it occurs to me we might want to backtrack about four or five sentences here, and we've been referring to the great books. You and I obviously know what they are. Maybe you should give us a quick recapitulation of the whole the great bookshelf and exactly what it was Adler was doing and what you and I are talking about here.
Yeah, I'll do my best. The great books idea, which is how I refer to it in my dissertation, is something that began in the latter half of the 19th century, mostly in Britain, actually. Hmm. And Matthew Arnold, who is known more for his poetry than his nonfiction writings today, Matthew Arnold was a proponent of learning one's culture or gaining culture through studying what we would refer to today as the great books. And anyway, that the movement sort of began over there and then migrated through literature professors into the U.S. and slowly made its way to Columbia University, where there were a couple of professors there, literature professors, who proved very instrumental in passing the great books idea on to Mortimer Adler. The first one was George Woodberry, and then the next one was John Erskine. Erskine was Adler's teacher in the 1920s in a class called General Honors, which was basically a great books class as we know it. But anyway, the great books themselves, today we think of them in two different senses. You have this larger idea, which is much more inclusive of all sorts of great works by people of color, women, everybody. And then you have a notion that's more connected with the 1952 edition of the great books of the Western world by Britannica. That, mm-hmm. that set was created. Adler helped create that set, and he edited it with Robert Hutchins. And anyway, so there's this particular kind of canon that people think of, which oftentimes they relate it to that Britannica set. And then just the whole term canon itself is kind of interchangeable with the great books, depending on how people feel about the issue. If they feel negatively about it, they call it a rigid canon that is non-inclusive and it should be expand all sorts of negative emotion around it. And then there is another way in which the canon represents the works that are sort of generally accepted by either literature scholars or in whatever field, right, history or philosophy, science, as being the kind of best books that we should know about.
Well, there's been in higher education, and just certainly in the whole time I've been hanging around, on and off, savage battles about what constitutes the canon in any given field. I'm trying to figure out how to tell a story without identifying the university in question. A Department of Iberian Language and Literature that I am vaguely aware of once tore itself apart over whether the literature involved was strictly that which came from the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, or in fact the son and daughter countries, Brazil, the South American countries, had a piece of that legitimate discourse of knowledge as well, and whether that canon of literature should be included. And this was a savage, bloody battle.
In the 1980s, there was a lot of there was a tug of war over what the great books idea meant, and that came to a head at Stanford, actually, with what they refer to today in the historiography as the Stanford debates, and a couple of issues are mixed together here. That was about a Western civilization course. And what's happened over time since the 1920s through the present is Western civilization courses tend to have a great books element to them. Sometimes they're interchangeable, sometimes not. The great books idea is a very fluid thing. Originally, it stood for reading whole texts and showing up in class and discussing them and trying to move through all of the greatest books of Western civilization over the course of 3 or 4 years, right? This is how Erskine envisioned the course in the 1920s, reading whole books and talking about those books. I think the phrase that captures a lot of it is, quote, unquote, debonair amateurs. This is something that Adler forwarded this idea in his autobiography, that you don't need to be an expert, right, that these books were not written for experts originally, and so we should be able to discuss them as debonair amateurs. And, you know, you're sort of introduced to different aspects of Western civilization, but you're not an expert in any one thing.
Mm-hmm.
You become culturally literate without becoming an expert in, say, all of the dramas of Shakespeare, right? You're just able to understand the sort of ideas in them or the aesthetic significance, et cetera. But anyway, over the course of time, by the time the 1980s rolled around and the Stanford debate occurred, these texts were being woven into Western civilization courses and used as source material, as kind of a string of beads that one would progress through all of Western civilization, sampling these various great authors. And so there's a debate about, there are lots of things mixed in the history of education here. It's the what is the nature of Western civilization? What do we need to know? What is our common cultural heritage? How do we go about studying our past and gaining an identity? How do the great books play a part in this? And so Adler became wrapped up in those debates, unfortunately, in a more dogmatic period of his life in the late 1980s and around 1990. So some of his contributions to education, the history of education, his view of the great books idea have become mixed up in these larger debates about what it means to be a classic and what it means to study Western civilization.
So in a way, what Erskine and Matthew Arnold had proposed is as a, in the very original meaning of the term, a broad liberal arts education.
Exactly.
By the time along toward the end of Adler's life, had become, and again I'll raise the issue of Alan Bloom, a kind of a prescriptive this is our civilization, and you know, everybody else is a little suspect kind of a thing.
Yeah, there is a element of elitism and arrogance,
right.
And Adler specifically cited Alan Bloom, William Bennett. Adler didn't even appreciate or he was very critical of the 1983 A Nation at Risk report because he felt that it was focused too much on getting students through high school and on to college. So Adler was very concerned about bringing that kind of liberal view of a liberal education down to the level where all citizens would have a chance to experience it. And of course, this is at Adler's high point. He had low points, and some of his legacy is deserved, but then there's another portion of it that's undeserved. For instance, at the conference we were at, I was talking with you about how to read a book, or not with you, I was presenting a paper on how to read a book. And I consider that one of Adler's, you know, high points, one of his contributions to the notion, to the discussion about what it means to have a liberal education. And, you know, a sort of better version of the great books idea.
Well, yeah, the how to read a book paper I thought was pretty interesting, to the point where I'm actually going to go find a copy and read it since I've now been reading all my life. Maybe I should figure out what I've been missing. So the whole great books idea, clearly predates the 1952 Great Books of the Western World bookshelf.
Oh, yeah, by almost 100 years, I would say.
Well,
75.
We could talk about, you know, there were predecessors. There was a Harvard bookshelf, for instance, that came out when?
That was around 1910. That was President Eliot's Harvard Classics.
Right.
And it was also a sort of very liberal notion, or should I say an iteration of the great books idea. And it wasn't as systematic, though, as the Britannica that would be in 1950. One of the key differences between the Britannica set and all other versions of the great books idea, at least published versions, right? You could talk about Everyman's Library, the Harvard Classics, the Modern Library. But anyway, the 52 edition of the great books contained this sort of learning instrument that was called the Great Ideas or the Syntopicon.
Mm-hmm.
They created a special term for these two books. And what these two books did, these two versions of the Syntopicon, it was an A to Z library of what they saw as around the 100 great ideas that had been discussed throughout Western civilization. Now, it wasn't just 100, of course. These were just the larger terms that covered all sorts of subordinate ideas that were within these 100 that were listed. Anyway, these ideas were created as a kind of history of Western civilization within these two books. It was a history of ideas, and it involved a certain view of how history could be written, the intellectual history could be written.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that was what was unique about that set as compared to earlier versions of the idea. And so it's because it's systematic, a lot of people enjoyed and bought the Britannica set of great books thinking that they could become self-learners, right? They could engage in their own sort of adult education project without having to attend classes.
Well, in a way, that to bring libraries into it, since this is a library program, one of the great ideas of the American public library was the people's university. So maybe writ a little larger. And the difference between, for instance, the Harvard bookshelf, the 1910, which was, as you mentioned, kind of a scattergun sort of thing, when by the time the 1952 Encyclopedia Britannica edition came out, there was a plan. There was the Syntopicon. There was almost a directed study thing that went along with those books.
Right.
That's overstating it a little bit. But now, how did St. John's College of Annapolis, Maryland, and Santa Fe, New Mexico, fit into this? Those are one institution with two campuses that is based on the great books idea.
Right. Right. Once again, here you have the great books as they're envisioned on a campus have a spectrum of range in terms of the history of the great books idea, right? You have on some campuses, I'm talking to you from Loyola University Chicago. Loyola has an honors course that covers the history of ideas in the West. Now, that course is a covert great books course. They don't call it great books, I think, because of the baggage, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But at St. John's, those two schools have entire four-year curriculums that are based on these lists that roughly correspond with Mortimer Adler and, once again, Robert Hutchins' particular view of the great books and also the Erskine General Honors course. Their lists grow out of those particular historical instances. Now, representatives from those campuses, of course, could correct us and tell us how that they have improved upon or how they deviate from those original views. But it was Adler and Hutchins and some others, what I call a kind of community of discourse, that were all located at the University of Chicago in the 1930s. And in 1937, a couple of them broke away to help form the original St. John's campus that was in Annapolis,
mm-hmm.
or that's still in Annapolis. Now, there are other iterations, right, of the Great Books idea, and Catholic schools adopt sort of their own version. There's a St. Thomas Aquinas College in California that follows a Great Books program. There's a college here in the Chicago area, Scheimer College, which follows another version. It's been in existence since the 1970s. So there are these variations, right, on the Great Books idea, and how it's applied on a college campus, of course, is dependent on that college's politics, size, practicality, finances, all sorts of things.
Well, that's pretty much describes what happens on any college campus.
Yeah, absolutely.
It strikes me as you were going through that sort of iteration of not just St. John's but the other places that this is clearly a powerful notion, and that 100-odd years later after Matthew Arnold, we still have viable institutions of higher education. We're still debating this whole idea. Did St. John's or any of these other places go through that same sort of spasm of self-examination in the 80s go back to the 60s even?
I'm not so sure about how there's sort of internal politics or dialogue on those campuses. I guess so much is running through my mind based on what you said. These schools, well, let me return to the idea of the sort of power behind the great books idea. What I think appeals to people universally over time is the idea of reading directly from a text of straight from the author's mouth, right, as they say. And I think that is what is, you know, what carries on the idea to the present, what's held it together is people's desire to read from original source material. I mean, it's sort of the principle behind historians going to archives, right? I mean, that people want to know what was originally said. They want to know interpretations, and they want to hear other people's opinions about these things, but they want to experience the original text.
I probably shouldn't mention this to somebody at Loyola, but this is a very Protestant notion we're talking about here.
Yeah, I discussed this in my dissertation at one point. It's interesting that there's that notion of a sola scriptura, which dates from the Reformation and Martin Luther, where you want to study the Bible, you want to return to the Bible itself. And I think you're right. I think there is some sort of connection between that desire to understand the original text and then also deal with the teaching tradition, right? So once again, to bring that Protestant Catholic notion in there, Catholics rely on the sort of tradition and scripture, and Protestants tend to focus on the Bible itself. So anyway, there's this, yeah, you could say that there's both strains of that in the history of education with regard to the great books idea.
What was Matthew Arnold? Was he Church of England or was he Roman Catholic?
No, I don't know his particular creed or how he existed within the convent. I think he was Anglican, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, but
what mattered to him was these great texts and being able to hear from the sources themselves and discuss those sources. And that's what he talks about in an essay in his most famous work. It's called Culture and Anarchy. Now, I don't want to put it all on Matthew Arnold, because there were others that are sort of between Arnold and Erskine and Adler. Sir John Lubbock had a text or a speech where he talked about the 100 great books, and this speech was reprinted numerous times. It was originally given in like 1896 or so, and this is reprinted just after the turn of the into the 20th century as one of the world's great orations, and newspapers reprinted it. It was in the New York Times. It was something that people gravitated to. It was a means to deal with the burgeoning list of books and publications that were occurring in the late 19th century. This print publication apparatus that we have today came into being around that time. And
right,
I think people were looking for guidance. And so originally Great Books Idea is this sort of popular notion to help people weed through all of the chaff, as they say, right? And then it migrated to universities as a means to help provide a kind of unifying course, right, in the face of the elective system, that which was also coming into being around the 1880s and 1890s.
Yeah, Eliot, I think, introduced it at Harvard in 1880-something or other.
Right. Right around that time.
So that's interesting. I was thinking about, you were talking about the availability of books, and I was thinking about the whole technology of books and printing and how it really exploded, particularly after the Civil War, American Civil War, when woodpulp paper, and then the invention of the high-speed rotary press a little later in the century, and there must have been a huge kind of information overload, and somebody come up with a list of 20 good books that I can read, and so I don't have to make all these decisions.
So you see the Great Books Idea is taking hold in a sort of Western culture, or at least English-speaking Western culture, at a nexus of various events, the elective system, the explosion of books in terms of number of publications. There was a guy, Richardson, who wrote a book called The Choice of Books, and this is around 1885 or 1880 or so, somewhere in that range. And he's complaining in that book about the thousands of books that are being printed every year and how does one weed through them. And so in his book, he's talking about – it's kind of like a Harold Bloom sampling of all of the greats, right?
Right.
Harold Bloom wrote that great books where he's just sampling through various he also wrote How to Read and Why, and he does sort of the same thing, talks about the great text and what's attractive about them.
Well, it's interesting. I was thinking about, again, relating it back to libraries, that it wasn't terribly long after the turn of the 20th century that the whole business of book selection and weeding through this mass of material, because clearly no library could afford everything,
right.
And the whole question of best books to put on or for the library to spend money on. So there's clearly a great deal of that must have been weeding through this great latter part of the 19th century information explosion, for which they may have been kind of ill prepared in a lot
right.
of ways.
Right. I don't think they anticipated the simple explosion, the quantitative increase that
right.
they would have to deal with. Now, how the Great Books Idea intersects with the history of libraries is something that I'm not able to explore as much in my dissertation and in other works, but there is a relation there.
Oh yeah.
And I know that the libraries themselves, once they transitioned to the open shelf concept, they're dealing with how to guide readers and what to mm-hmm. you know what to send them to, I guess you could say, on mm-hmm. the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
And I do see that those are related, but I haven't fully explored that and librarians' feelings about the great books idea. I mean, all I know is that today here in the city of Chicago, our flagship library of the Chicago Public Libraries is the Harold Washington Library down
right.
here in the Loop. And the Harold Washington Library has continuously offered a great books course for years and years and years. And the Chicago Public Libraries were instrumental in acting as a place where great books enthusiasts could come and meet as early as the 1940s. Adler's How to Read a Book caused a kind of mini sensation in the 40s, a clamoring for how do I get involved in this? This sounds great, you know, this sort of public phenomenon of wanting to understand the great books idea.
Yeah.
And so the Chicago Public Libraries were happy, of course, to host anything that's going to get people's noses in the text.
Well, I think when you get to library land, you're going to find there are echoes. It may not be phrased using the terminology, the great books, but we have had in library land savage debates, certainly even during my career, as to classics or trash. You know, there's a whole school of thought coming out of Baltimore County and Maryland, you know, give them what circulates and the hell with the classics, that sort of thing.
Right.
So this whole, is, again, maybe not phrased using the great books, but the very definitely a debate over the content of the public library. Well, Tim, we're getting down towards the end of time here, and I want to thank you. This has been an interesting kind of an outside of library land look at books and reading. And I think I'll return to what I said earlier, that power that very clearly catches people, the idea that good books are a really good thing and a powerful driving force in Western society.
Yeah, if I could, as a final note here, I think Adler realized one of the things, that the nerve that he touched into, was a kind of democratic belief that everyone can at least give it a try, and they may have to, you know, reading the greatest works, and then they may have to do some more research to understand all the particulars, but at the very least they could be excited about the idea of approaching the sorts of literary masterpieces of Western civilization. So in that way, I think it really it helps the library by promoting literacy and love for reading overall.
Yeah, and on that we can certainly agree. Anything that gets them reading is just fine with me.
Sure.
Well, Tim, thanks again.
Thank
We're
you.
Out of time, and we'll talk to you again sometime.
All right, thanks.
So ends another session in the Tiger Eye Reading Room. Come back again for more interesting and, we hope, provocative discussions from the world of books. Reading, writing, publishing, promoting, care and feeding in a library. You know where the schedule is posted. See you next time on LIS Radio.
Is your library making a difference in the lives of people it's dedicated to serving? If it is, then someone in that organization might win a graduate scholarship from the University of Missouri Columbia. The Make a Difference Library Challenge is sponsored by the MU Graduate School and the MU School of Information Science and Learning Technologies. We challenge your library to make a difference in the quality of your constituents' lives through innovative programs that employ information-rich and technology-intensive strategies to meet their needs. For more information about the Make a Difference program, check out our website, makeadifference.missouri.edu. That's make-a-difference.missouri.edu. This webcast is brought to you by the School of Information Science and Learning Technologies at the University of Missouri, and made possible by a gift from the Verizon Foundation.